All right, welcome back. Our guest tonight is Isaac Arthur. He's the host of Science and Futurism, and his channel is linked over at Coast to Coast AM, and you can go check that out. And when we come back after the break, we're going to discuss faster than light travel and communication, of course, dark energy. When we come back after the break, continuing the conversation with Isaac Arthur, jumping straight into faster than light. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. This is Coast to Coast AM. All right, welcome back. Coast to Coast AM standing in on the Saturday night. It's 11, 11, 11, 11 on the studio clock. You got to love it when that happens. That's when you come back off of a commercial break. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Heading into Sunday morning, our guest tonight is Isaac Arthur, host of Science and Futurism. And the links to his channel are over at coasttocoastam.com. Now, Isaac, faster than light. Faster than light, and in any context, was something that was never discussed or contemplated. It's not that kind of party these days, but, you know, Einstein laid it out pretty elegantly in his theory of relativity and his special theory. But today, faster than light is openly discussed and theorized, isn't it?
Well, there's been some discussion of it almost all along, but there is exactly what you said there. Einstein's theory on that just doesn't leave us too much wiggle room to find a way to go at the speed of light or faster than the speed of light. And where we do have the options, they tend to involve things like negative matter or the Alcubierre warp drive, which technically does not violate Einsteinian relativity, although it does let you go faster than light from a practical standpoint. And so there are options on the table there. They tend to be tricky, though, because almost all of them allow you to violate causality, or basically to engage in time travel, too. So they open up quite the Pandora's box if they turn out to be true.
Well, okay, so let's stay right here. This is my favorite subject, man. I need to get my learn on, Isaac. You and I, we've got our special ship. Right? And not that we approach the speed of light. Let's say we're there. We're traveling at the speed of light. What are we seeing? Not only out the windows, because if we're traveling at the speed of light, does light even get to us? Or is it elongated? I also picture Spaceballs, the movie, right? When they go to Plaid, right? Well, I mean, yeah. What is it that we see? Number one. And number two, are we frozen in time? In that, are we literally not aging? Or are we going backwards or forwards?
Well, it's always kind of hard to speak about what happens with interactions when you're at the speed of light, because technically nothing should happen at all. Photons and probably neutrinos travel at the speed of light. And for them, they actually experience no time. As you get closer and closer to the speed of light, time begins to slow down to anyone who's watching you. You, of course, see distances shrink instead.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get to the speed of light, which you shouldn't be able to do because you take an infinite amount of energy, you would simply see time, you would simply stop. You would instantly transport to wherever you were going to. But as you got closer and closer to that, you would see stars getting blue shifted, which is say they'd be getting the ones that were red in color, as it were, they'd be getting bluer. The ones that were blue will be going up in the ultraviolet range. And of course, if you actually managed to find some way to go faster than the speed of light, you wouldn't be able to see anything behind you because the light could never actually catch up to you. So
that's right.
It would be, we don't like to say a black hole behind you, per se, because that gives the impression you're dragging one behind you, but there is an event horizon. You cannot see behind you because no light's catching up.
And at that moment, we're at the speed of light, and you and I are standing at the controls, right? And I look down at my watch. What is my watch doing?
As far as you can tell, because time's slowing down for the watch and it's slowing down for you, nothing's happening from your perspective. Instead, what's happening is the distance in front of you is shrinking. So like you're heading towards Andromeda, which we normally say is 2 million light years away.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll look at it, and your watch will be going fine. But the distance to Andromeda will seem to be shrinking in front of you. And so it's the speed of light's a constant, but speed is distance over time. So if that speed has stayed constant, either time is slowing down or distance is shrinking. And of course, you can't experience time slowing down personally because you experience that time. So for you, the distance shrinks instead.
Now, you and I are standing at the console, and I take out a baseball, and I throw it at the window, right? Did I just throw that baseball faster than the speed of light? If we are traveling at the speed of light and I spill my coffee forward, right? if am I spilling my coffee faster than the speed of light?
No, and this is what gets people, because that's the intuitive break we had a little over a century ago. That's the common sense approach. That's basic relativity. I'm going 1 meter per second slower than the speed of light, so if I throw a baseball forward, now it's going fast the speed of light, but it actually isn't. I will see it going at its normal speed because I'm not moving as far as I'm concerned. It will land and bounce off the bridge model and come back and hit me, right? To anyone who's looking at it, it appears to be going faster than I am, but it doesn't actually go faster than the speed of light because everything is just slowing down or shrinking. So that's the thing that's so hard to kind of wrap one's mind around, is that this speed is a constant. The speed of light is a constant. And because speed is distance over time, instead of, you know, just throw that ball and have it go faster, distances and time slow down to adjust it so that the speed's the same, but the distance or the time shrinks instead.
So if I am an interstellar state police car and I've got my radar detector out, right, and we zip by at the speed of light and I throw that baseball, it wouldn't be detected moving faster than the speed of light?
Nope. Yeah, they would see you going just a hair under the speed of light, and they'd see that ball going just a hair faster than you, but still a hair slower than the speed of light.
It's so difficult for me to wrap my mind around. If we brought
I wouldn't say it ruined, because it improved on ultra science, but it basically destroyed our concept for how distance and time worked.
Right, right.
It's confusing because that's exactly what it is. It's paradoxical. Right?
It's completely paradoxical. Yes.
Paradoxical.
Well, so if I was in an airplane, if I was in a bus, I'm trying to slow it down here, okay? If we're on a bus traveling 55 miles an hour, and I'm in the back of the bus, and I take out that baseball, and I throw it, and I hit the driver in the back of his head, isn't that baseball traveling faster than 55 miles an hour?
To anyone standing on the roadside, absolutely. And from your perspective, assuming you've got a good arm on you, I'm not sure how fast most people throw, probably on a 100-mile-an-hour ball, but yeah. That's normal world relativity. And until you start getting much, much faster than anything we have going on Earth, that holds up real well. That's the classic Newtonian Galilean relativity. And special relativity is this strange concept that speed, again, being made of distance divided by time, can be a set thing, but those distances and those times can change for the observer, so that even though you would think that this ball would be going faster than the speed of light, you won't actually measure it that way, and it's not actually quite doing it.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. I don't want to understand it because, the fantasy part of it, the other side of it, is what I want to be real, in that if you and I are traveling at the speed of light and I turn on the headlights to the spaceship, are those headlights now traveling double the speed of light? Or are there no headlights at all because the light doesn't have a chance to even get away from the front of the spaceship, right?
Theoretically, if you were traveling actually at the speed of light and you turned the headlights on, yeah, you couldn't actually turn them on because no time's passing for you. Those photons wouldn't seem to go anywhere.
Right.
But if you were going just a little under the speed of light, you turn them on, you would measure those photons moved away from you at the speed of light.
Well, and that's the crazy thing. They would only be so many feet in front of us. Right? Because we would be catching up to it.
Oh, no. From our perspective, time slowed down, we'd see them racing away because we think we're stationary. When we're moving, it's like everything else is moving. It's like sitting on board the bus. You don't feel like you're moving.
And right,
from your perspective, you're not.
Right.
Those photons would seem to race away from us if we're going just a little on the speed of light. At the speed of light, though, we can't actually experience any time, so we couldn't see them not moving.
Now, when we are traveling at the speed of light, If we hit something, what would happen? If we hit a piece of stardust, what would happen?
When you're up at those kind of speeds, you're effectively carrying infinite energy at light speed and real close to it when you're getting up close to those kind of speeds. We have something called antimatter, which is even worse pound for pound than nuclear weapons are. And when you're going those kind of speeds, any little pebble or grain of sand you hit is going off like a nuclear bomb. It's one of the reasons why it's probably a good idea not to colonize space much faster than maybe a tenth the speed of light. Because you don't have to pay all that energy building up that speed, and you don't have to worry about slamming into things that will wreck your ship.
And so what do we do to avoid that? We need to talk force fields, some type of really amazing radar. I would imagine lasers or some type of defensive weapons to, you know, disintegrate objects that are in front of us at those speeds.
Well, we actually have quite a few options on the table. One of them is very low-tech. We all see shields in science fiction. They're these energy shields. But one option you have, if you don't find methods like force fields, is a real old classic shield like knights and soldiers used to use. You put in front of your ship a big, dumb object that can just take some blows, and it's cheap, it gets shredded, and you replace it. And you just kind of push it ahead of you with a little bit of a laser beam so it stays ahead of you, and you let it soak up the damage, and you put your sensor packages on that so you're not trying to detect a grain of sand as far off as Pluto is in front of you. And you might have mini layers or something like that. So not as high-tech or cool as what they got in Star Trek, but it works, you know.
And what about collisions with other, I mean, space is empty. You know, the distances are vast. What would the odds be of hitting another spacecraft?
What are the odds of hitting another airplane? If you're near a place where they're all at, it's quite high. But the space is so big that if you're going between two stars, there's a fairly set corridor you'd expect everything to be traveling along. And even though it's a big enough corridor, you probably wouldn't bump into each other physically. But as huge as space is, a line is still a line. If you're traveling between the same two set of stars, you're probably going to pass by each other fairly close. And hopefully you wouldn't bump into each other. It's a good idea to announce your presence when going through space.
Because more than likely, wherever they are coming from, space is big. That's probably where we are going to. Right. Yeah. If you think about it, and whatever we are leaving from behind us is probably where that ship would be going to. Right. Am I making sense?
No, almost certainly. We actually have something called Olbers paradox, which tries to explain why the night sky isn't entirely white. If you go in any direction long enough, you should bump into another star. And if that was the case, you'd expect the entire night sky to be bright white, because again, far enough any direction, you'll see a star. But the distances between the stars is so immense that you just don't intersect each other. If you're running across another spaceship, it's because it's going to where you came from. And so you probably want to talk to them. You know, you got two fleets passing the night, as it were. If you go passing by them, it's because they're going where you are and you're heading where they are. So you probably want to chat.
How long would it take to slow down?
It depends on a good fighter pilot can handle, I think, 10 Gs for a few seconds. You have to check that one. But humans experience a 1G acceleration as normal gravity on Earth. And that's probably about the most that a normal human could handle for acceleration. At that speed, at that acceleration rate, it takes you about a year to get up close to light speed. So you probably, because you'll feel like you're under heavy gravity if you're slowing down faster than that, you probably have to spend about a year getting up to speed and a year slowing down.
So everything is done. What I'm getting at is nothing is accidental. I mean, it would be very deliberate, and you know about these plans months and months and months in advance.
Oh, yeah. If we're assuming an alien ship coming by as you're passing by, you don't recognize that ship. You know, it's not somebody who's just coming from a ward you're visiting. That's part of a regular shipping process. You are going to want to attack them or stop and talk to them, because it is not a coincidence they are headed towards your planet. That just doesn't happen on accident. And those kind of rangers, they know that planet's inhabited too.
And those are the plans. And now, as we are talking about faster than light and this interstellar travel, dark energy, it's too complex to get into right now, but the expansion of our universe, we thought that gravity would overtake it. This was the popular theory for forever, and that it would reverse gravity, would pull it back together. Big Bang would repeat, wash, rinse, repeat. expand and contract. But it doesn't appear to be the case today in that dark energy is pushing the universe apart infinite. And that the outer reaches of the universe right now, those galaxies and planets and stars are quite possibly traveling faster than the speed of light. They've outran the speed of light, so we don't even see them anymore, and they have effectively disappeared. Are you on that side of the fence?
Oh, yes. The evidence is pretty solid for that. The observable universe, we have no idea how big the real universe is. It could, in fact, be infinite. But the observable universe is this constantly expanding area. And we get to see more and more of it as time goes on because light from further and further places reaches us. But at the same time, as the universe expands, the observable universe, we are hemorrhaging mass as galaxy after galaxy on the very edge of things follows over what we call the cosmological event horizon. And for all practical purposes, they are moving faster than light. They themselves are not actually moving like that, but the space between them and us is growing so quickly that the light from them will never be able to reach us. And it's about 7% of light speed for every billion light years that you go.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the Hubble expansion rate. You usually see it as 20 megaparsecs or something like that. If you get far enough away, you get to the edge of the universe because no light can ever actually reach you. That's the edge of the observable universe, of course, and we don't know how much further goes after that. We think it's probably a lot bigger than the observable universe, but how much bigger, we have no way of knowing.
Isn't it a fascinating, almost frightening thought that out there, that there are galaxies that are invisible because they are faster than light and they are just going in one direction and you won't see it coming or going because of its speed?
It's kind of mind-boggling. The sheer size of the universe is mind-boggling to begin with. So it's the thing about astronomy. You can never really wrap your head around the scale. It's infinity in one direction and infinity in another. There's so much time, there's so much space, and it's all expanding so quickly. And it's just, how do you wrap your head around something that big?
And what do we do with those concepts now when we talk about dark energy? 15 seconds, and then we'll pick it up after the break. I mean, is dark energy the answer to all of the math and physics?
Well, there's so much we don't know about it. Dark energy is exactly that. It's dark to us. We know more about dark matter than we know about dark energy by far, and we know very little about dark matter, sadly. Dark energy is still so much of a mystery other than what it does, which is create new space.
Our guest tonight is Isaac Arthur. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. It is moving into Sunday morning. We'll be right back after this short break. Stay with us. Coming up, let me give you the rundown of my and George's schedule over the next couple of months. In 2 short weeks, George and I will be at the Conscious Life Expo right here in Los Angeles, California. It is at the LAX Hilton. That is February 22nd through the 25th. Today's February 10th. All right. Now, on Friday, I'll be there hosting the Ancient Aliens panel, celebrating the 50th anniversary of Chariots of the Gods, and I'll be doing that with Eric Von Daniken. That'll be Friday night. Saturday night, on the 23rd, George will be hosting the Cosmic Questions Forum. Of course, I'll be there for that. And later on Saturday night, will be the Speaker Reception and Meet and Greet Award Ceremony. So come and hang out with us. That's February 22nd through the 25th. Tickets and info are over in the events section at coasttocoastam.com. And then right after that, coming up Saturday, March 23rd, it's George Norrie Live at the historic Everett Theater up in Everett, Washington. That's almost sold out. Tickets are very limited for that. And you've got to go and check that out, though. Head to the events section because the guest this time around, Peter Davenport, Johnny Enoch, Danian Brinkley, and John Hogue. And, of course, there's going to be a live band and you get to hang out and meet and greet after the show. And then, coming up, it is George and Norrie Live kicking it in Columbus at the Lincoln Theater in Columbus, Ohio. And that is Saturday, May 11th, 2019. And that's with Marianne Winkowski, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, Stanton Friedman, and special Mother's Day tribute, live band, audience participation, and of course, that famous George Norrie meet and greet after the show. Just go to the events section at coasttocoastam.com. Isaac Arthur is our guest. We're discussing everything E.T. and Interstellar, and we were finishing up with dark energy. I'm going to get into faster-than-light communication, and we've got to discuss the Kardashev scale and take some of your phone calls. All of that is next. This is Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Our guest tonight, Isaac Arthur. Isaac, faster-than-light communication. You and I have debated this, and I think we're far apart in the concepts of this, but faster-than-light communication, it has to be if you have interstellar travel. How would they get it done?
Well, not necessarily, just because you've got these huge voids of space. You need it for a cohesive empire, but you could still go out and colonize without it. As for how we go about doing it, it's the same problem we have with FTL for any number of methods. If we can find a way to do it, it obviously saves us a lot of difficulty, even just having communication without the travel. The problem is it runs into those same relativity issues of more than anything else, causality. Almost every method we can think of that might let you do faster-than-light communication gives us the problem that you can call somebody before, you know, to reply to them before they called you in the first place. So you go to pick up the phone to call somebody, and it rings first, so they're like, yeah, I got your message, and so we're getting back to you. And that causes us a lot of problems from a theoretical standpoint, because if somebody could call you from the future, we would tend to think they had already have done so.
Well, then all you would do, you wouldn't talk to anybody in real time. You would just leave a message, right? That's what you would do.
You'd almost have to, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I called you. Yeah, I got your message 10 minutes ago. Right? That's what we're talking about here, because it would get here before...
You're getting a message back from someone you haven't called yet. And so there are a few constructs that might deal with it, like the, I'm going to mispronounce this, the Nokia self-consistency principle that says that no matter what you do, and not the time set, but you're always going to end up going back to a path that maintains that time. Kind of like water falling down on a house. It's going to bend up back in the ocean eventually, but it's got so many different ways of getting there. And, of course, that's a theory. It's a principle, I should say, not even a theory. But you'd almost have to have something like that, because if it was a rule that people followed as opposed to a rule of the universe, how would you possibly go about enforcing it when someone could literally call before you've made that rule to do something that's going to prevent you from making that rule?
That's right. And if you are occupying and expanding through your star system or galaxy, even the solar system, if you're going to do that, to communicate in real time, that is what you have to overcome, because you don't want your emergency call beacon distress signal not get received for 5 years.
Well, it's a big problem. It is one that is potentially overcomeable, if not for the purpose of maintaining sort of civilization, but for spreading out. When we were hunter-gatherers, we got all over the planet without having any way of talking to each other other than walking. And so obviously you couldn't maintain an empire back then, but we still had civilizations arise. So we can still get out there and colonize the galaxy if it turns out that there's no way to go faster than speed of light or communicate faster than speed of light, but you couldn't maintain a civilization itself. And as for methods we can do for that, almost everything we've looked at is, we've yet to come up with one that looks like a solid option, but we've only been trying for a century, so there's still some room.
Okay, so now let's talk about another concept, which would be communication through consciousness or entanglement, where now things are not at the speed of light, but in real time at the same time.
That's always a little bit trickier with things like what we call it spooky action at distance with quantum entanglement. We don't know how fast that actually occurs, though it goes faster than light, presumably, but which might seem contradictory just about not knowing how to do that. But we don't know if it goes instantaneous or not. And the problem is that while it does send a piece of information, the only information it seems to send from your perspective until someone tells you what somebody looked at is a random zero or one. You don't know what that zero or one is, and they can't control if they sent you a zero or one. So it's kind of like somebody sent you a letter in the mail. I get somebody a letter and I send them a two pieces of paper. I write a zero on one half of it and a one on the other. I rip them in half and I put them in an envelope. I mail those two envelopes to other people. When that one person opens it up, they get a zero. They know the other person got a one.
Mm-hmm.
Even though that person might be on the other side of the universe, they instantaneously know that person got a one. But they don't have any way of actually using that to send each other information faster and light, other than what that person had, that zero or that one. And that's kind of the problem we have so far with quantum entanglement.
Well, in 100 years or 1,000 years, I think that we would have completely overcome those issues, and we would be sending data back and forth with entanglement in real time with massive amounts. I would think that ET has overcome the same issues.
Well, hopefully, but at the moment, we still don't have a method for doing it. So we might come up with something better. It might turn out that one doesn't work. It's one of those things where we've got billions or trillions of years to hack this problem. So if there is a solution, we will find it. But you don't necessarily have one. You know, a 2 plus 2 might equal 5 in some universes, but it might be hard to find one where it does not equal 4. We don't know that there's a solution for this, but if there is one, maybe we'll find it in the next century, but we will find it eventually.
Now, the Kardashev scale, we are very familiar with a type 1, a type 0, type 1, type 2, type 3 civilizations as presented. Anyway, I don't want to spend time on this. We understand that, but the Kardashev scale is something that isn't discussed quite as often, and I'm not comfortable with it, and I think it needs to be refined or maybe even rewritten. But what is the Kardashev scale?
I would almost say for most of the purposes that people use it, we'd be better off abandoning it for it. When Kardashev came up with the idea, he was saying, how would we detect these things astronomically? And so he said, well, you might have an entire planet's capacity of energy being used. That's a Kardashev 1, and we're not quite there yet. Kardashev 2 is when you use a whole sun, and Kardashev 3 is when you use all the power output of an entire galaxy. And one's about a billion times the other, and the other's a billion times the other one. So it's very broad, and it only talks about power consumption. So it's not good for things like technology levels or populations. And of course, people always will say, is there a K4? And we don't really have a solid definition for what that would be. It might be like an entire supercluster or an observable universe. But the Kardashev scale is very handy for discussing loose concepts of SETI, but it's not too handy for discussing those potential civilizations in any sort of useful detail.
Well, only because it's like you have the number one, you have the number two, and then you have the number 80 gazillion quadrillion, right? It's like two, they don't relate to each other.
Too non-specific, yeah. By coincidence, the difference in power between what the Earth gets and what the sun puts out is about the same area as what the sun puts out relative to the galaxy. But that is just a coincidence. And there's really not much in between room. You know, what's the difference? They say all these high-tech empires we see in, you know, science fiction like Star Trek or the Empire from Star Wars, I say, what are these? Are these Kardashev 2? And say, no, these are like Kardashev 1.3, maybe. They're very low powered and often not too well represented. You know, like a Death Star, for instance, from Star Trek, that actually has produced more energy than a star would to do what we see it do in New Hope. Because if you're using all the output of our own sun to blow up a planet, you actually need to focus that beam down for a full week to blow up a planet size more.
And when we're talking about something like the Kardashev scale, and I want to go back and tie all of this together, and entanglement and data transfer and the speed of light, when we start to look at all of this where we are technically, and we equate that to certain science fiction principles that are being explored today, like teleportation, is teleportation something that is completely unachievable? Because you hear Brian Greene talk about it, and Brian Greene, it lays it out like, okay, we're just a couple of months away. As soon as we figure this next step out, I don't know if I want to be the first one to do it, but theoretically it's completely possible, and especially with entanglement and assigning things an identifier at the other end, right? You scan your body, you identify every single atom in your body, and then you re-identify atoms on the other end, and you reassemble yourself, right?
That's one of the possible ways you could do that, though. The problem is, it's we think of communications as being very low power and you know, not really all that hard to do. But if you actually are using a data point for every single atom in your body, you'd be talking about an insane amount of energy to beam that. It would basically be a laser beam between you and another solar system that was very high intensity. And I'm not too sure there'd be many occasions where you'd actually do that, but you could do data compression. You know, the DNA in your body is, you know, trillions of examples of DNA in your body that are more or less the same. And, you know, there's maybe one thing different in each one in your body. You don't really need to have the DNA in each cell be exact copies of the original. And, of course, that gets into things like the ship of Theseus and whether or not a perfect copy is really necessary to still be you. And, of course, the big one is, what about the you back home? You know, there's no reason why it would necessarily have vaporized you. Now there's two copies of you. What do you do with the old one?
Somebody's committing suicide.
Oh, yeah. And of course, the problem is, what do you do if it's not instantaneous and you've got somebody sticking around there if they are meant to be vaporized? Now they're still sticking around. Can you just shoot them? I wouldn't think so. But
that's right. That's right. And now what about putting that issue aside? Because that is a serious moral issue. It's like we would have to have the teleporting police monitoring both ends. You know, at the instant your new body is completed and your mind is there and your conscious is there too as well, then they pull the trigger on the original. Right? I mean, because there can't be two of you.
Though you'd be waiting decades to find out if the copy made it intact. So.
Which is the next point. It's the amount of data that is transferred. Now, we know what we can, you know, move around today with our primitive internet and the way that data and transfer speeds work today. But to transfer the data for your body, what are we dealing with here? And what kind of time are we dealing with for that data transfer?
In some models, and again, it depends on whether or not you're willing to do data compression. If you want to transmit the exact state of every single atom, I have to double check the numbers on this, but you'd be potentially talking about a very high bandwidth transmission lasting millions of years, something along those lines, to send all that data, just because that's a huge amount of information. And there's no real way to speed that up too much. But you can compress it. Again, you don't really need all the cells in your body to be, you know, most of the data is repeated. I don't need to send every last bit. And that might let us compress it down. It's the mind that we probably need to send. But that's pretty debatable, too. Where does the mind in with the body's connection? And so that's, I'm not sure that's one of those ones that really has an answer, though, because how do you establish that the copy really is the original for all practical purposes, or in, you know, for real? How do you know that the copy is as valid as the original, or is the original?
And so the original is eliminated, right? You're gone. Your new copy is out there. Do you run into the same cloning degradation that we are experiencing today? You know, a clone of a clone of a clone eventually is a continuum of errors.
Well, copy fatigue is a potential issue or something like that, but we do have a bit of an advantage. The more you actually know about genetics and the science behind what builds people, the more you can reconstruct that copy. If I get a copy that's a bit fatigued, it's a bit blurry of some text, since I can read and write, I can figure out what those words were, transcribe them again as a fresh copy, and eliminate that copy fatigue. Hopefully, though you could start getting transcription errors where people thought it was a word, but it was the wrong one. And of course, that's a data integrity issue. We do have some ways of dealing with that, that of course we have to deal with all the time with the internet. Things like checksum, for instance, where you make sure you add up all the bits in its little chunk of data, and if they don't add to the right number, you have to resend that bit of data, that packet. So we do have a lot of ways to try to deal with, you know, copy fatigue in terms of data. But again, when you're transmitting, if you are limited to the speed of light, you're transmitting over decades of distance, it is kind of hard to get those verifications that you send the right packets. So then you have to start sending multiple copies for them to compare and check against.
That. Right.
That just increases your bandwidth even more.
I can imagine what the pop culture vocabulary would be like in the future. Man, that Isaac's looking a little blurry. Have you seen him lately? Yeah, man, he's gone back and forth a few times. You know, and that's the crazy part of all of this is the integrity of those types of transfers. When you see it in Star Trek, right, going back and forth from the ship to the planet and back, we don't understand actually what is going on there. It seems like fun and games, but if there is any mistake, it's bad news.
Oh, sure. And they've done a few episodes where they actually played about that. I think we had two copies of Will Reichel that they deal with in one episode. And, you know, you can't tell which copy is more. I mean, and even then, if it is a copy, does that make it any less a person? You know, and what, again, that is that big issue. What do you do with the old one? Because you say, well, you eliminate the old one, but the galaxy is a big place. So while you're colonizing, you don't really have any motivation to get rid of the original. So there's a copy of you and another copy of you on Alpha Centauri. They're not going to stay the same. They're getting different life experiences. So pretty soon there are two different people. So
yeah, let me jump in right there. I got to take a break. But also, what do you do with all of the dead bodies, too, as well? Those would stack up. This is Coast to Coast AM. Our guest, Isaac Arthur. We'll be right back.